On Sunday mornings, we're reading through the Gospel according to Matthew. And we've just come to the end of the section of the book that we call the Sermon on the Mount. That section started at the beginning of chapter 5, where we read these words. Jesus went up on the mountain. And when he sat down there, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them. And then Matthew gives us a summary of all that Jesus taught his disciples there on the mountain. He teaches them about the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom that he had come to establish on earth. And he spells out just what is involved in being a citizen of the kingdom. That's his great theme through the rest of chapter 5, and then on through chapter 6 and 7. And we've gone through it line by line, almost word by word. Listen again to the words with which Jesus closed that great teaching session there on the mountain. He said this: everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. That's Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 27. Now, the crowds who'd been there listening as Jesus taught them there in the open air on the mountain, how did they react to all that he had been saying? What impression did it leave on them? Matthew tells us in verse 28, when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching. Now remember, these were all disciples of Jesus. We were told that back in chapter 5, verse 1. So this wasn't the first time they'd ever encountered Jesus. These were people who already believed in him. They'd already decided that he was the man sent from God, that he was a man whom they could trust. They'd already decided that he was going to be their teacher, their master. But as they listened to him there, and as he came to the final thrust of his message, they were overwhelmed. Matthew says they were astonished. They felt, we've never heard anything like this. We never expected this. But why? What was it that shocked them? Well, Matthew tells us. They were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority, not as their scribes. What Jesus had been saying and the way he said it was utterly different from anything they'd ever heard from anyone else. There were lots of scribes around. These were expert religious teachers. Their job was to teach people how to live their lives, what God required of them. But Matthew says, Jesus didn't teach these people the way that their own scribes did, the teachers they'd looked to in the past. Jesus taught them as one who had authority. Now, to get the real impact of this, we need to know something of how other teachers, their scribes, did teach. So I brought along my copy of the Mishnah. It's a collection put together around 200 AD of the teachings that were passed down from the Jewish scribes, the rabbis from about 200 BC to 200 AD. So we've got lots of examples here of the way that the scribes in Jesus' time did teach. They taught on every conceivable subject. And I'm just going to give you a couple of quotes so that you get the flavor. Here's the scribes on one very important subject. The subject is the rules about gleaning. You know, the law in Israel said that when a farmer reaped his field, he had to leave a border around the field unreaped. So the people who had no land could come and just pick the crops there for themselves. But then people in Jesus' time had endless arguments about that law. How big the border had to be, how wide it should be. And if you had a field with two different crops growing in different parts of the field, do you need separate borders? Or should there just be one border for the whole field? Lots of questions like that. Well, it was the job of the scribes, it was the job of the religious teachers to give the right answers. So this is what happened in one case. Quote, I copied out some of the quotes. It once happened that Rabbi Simeon of Mizpah sowed his field before Rabban Gamaliel. The point is that you had these two rabbis who disagreed about the rules. So they went up, we're told, to the chamber of hewn stone to inquire. That's the sort of next court of experts. You could say the supreme court for the rabbis. And this was the ruling. Nahum the scrivener said, I have received a tradition from Rabbi Measha, who received it from his father, who received it from the Zugoth, who received it from the prophets, as a halakha given to Moses from Sinai, that if a man sowed his field in two kinds of wheat and made them up into one threshing floor, he grants one border. But if he uses two threshing floors, he must grant two borders. If the two crops in the two fields, the two crops in the one field are threshed in two different locations, they need separate borders. If they're threshed in one place, they count as one crop, so we only need to have one border. That was the ruling. But the thing I want you to see is the way that the rabbi argued his case. I know that this is the right approach because I heard it from Rabbi Measha. And he heard it from his father, who was a rabbi before him. And he heard it from the Zugoth, the teachers of the past 200 years. And they heard it from the prophets. And they heard it from Moses. His whole point is, this doesn't come from me. This is what's been handed down through the centuries. This rabbi saying, I don't have any authority. I can only relay to you what others have said. I'll give you another example. This is on the question of which families will be counted as clean when God finally intervenes in the world. Rabbi Joshua said, I have received a tradition from Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, who heard it from his teacher, and his teacher heard it from his teacher, as a halakha given to Moses from Sinai, that Elijah will not come to pronounce unclean or to pronounce clean, to put away or to bring near, but to put away those brought near by force and to bring near those put away by force. Don't worry about what on earth that means. The important thing is to see just the way that the rabbis taught. Rabbi Joshua said, I was taught this by Rabbi Yohanan, and he heard it from his teacher, and he heard it from his teacher. And the chain goes right back through all these teachers back to what Moses received on Mount Sinai. Do you see, the way that a rabbi proved that he was worth listening to was that he showed that his teaching came from someone else. And that person got it from someone else. And he got it from someone else. Right back, all the way back to Moses. And now listen to Jesus. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. You have heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of sexual immorality makes her commit adultery. Again, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you've sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Do you see? All the great religious teachers of the day, with them it was always so-and-so said that, and so-and-so said that. But with Jesus it was simply, I say to you. Jesus didn't need to appeal to anyone else's authority. He was claiming to have the final word on every subject. And the really startling thing is this, that when Jesus used those words, I say to you, again and again, he was setting his words in contrast with what the Old Testament said, what was written in the law of Moses. In the law of Moses, it said, whoever divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. Jesus quotes that, and then he gives his ruling. But I say to you, and he sets a new standard, a different standard entirely for his disciples. The law said, you shall love your neighbor. But Jesus just cuts across that and says, I say to you, you shall love your enemy. I say to you, I say to you, I say to you. You know, that's the drumbeat of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus claims the right to speak on every subject with final, total authority. He says it doesn't matter what anyone else has said. It doesn't matter what verses you quote from the law of Moses. I say to you, and I have the final word. You know, we've read this so many times that it's hard to really feel the shock of it. The people there on that mountain did. They were astonished. But we can miss it. A 30-year-old unmarried carpenter from a backward village called Nazareth, who's never had any theological training, in fact, never really had any advanced education, calmly claims the right to lay down the law on every subject, to overrule every expert, even to rewrite the law of Moses, the word of God. You know, if anyone else talked like this, we'd be gobsmacked by their self-confidence. We'd call it arrogance, wouldn't we? We might even think they needed to see a doctor. You know, occasionally we do meet someone like this. You know, he knows more than Einstein about physics. And he knows more than Bill Gates about the computer revolution. And he knows more than Steven Spielberg about filmmaking. And we shake our heads. And we escape as quickly as we can. But Jesus didn't just talk about petty subjects like those. He talked about marriage and divorce. About truth and lies. About life and death, about heaven and hell, about God. And he spoke as the one final authority on everything. I say to you. Do you remember, right back, however long ago it was, when we looked at the opening verses of chapter 5, we thought about why Jesus gave this sermon, this block of teaching, this manifesto, call it what you will, why he gave it up on a mountain. Remember, Jesus went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. You know, if you want to make yourself heard to a big crowd in the open air, the last place you go to is up on a mountain. Because there you have to compete with the wind. If you want to speak to a crowd, the best place to do it is in a hollow, a dip, where you're out of the wind and where your voice echoes off the sides. So why did Jesus go up on a mountain to teach those disciples? And the answer we gave was this. Jesus wanted to remind his disciples of an episode from the Old Testament, a vital epoch-making event. Moses, the man who was the greatest prophet in all the history of Israel, led the Israelites into the desert to a mountain called Sinai. They were going to learn there what God had to say to them, what God's will was for them. The mountain, it was shrouded in dark, dense cloud. And you could see glimpses of blazing fire breaking through the cloud. And the Israelites knew that God was there. That God had come down upon the mountain. They knew that their king, the ultimate king, had taken that mountain as his throne. And the Israelites were terrified. They were cowering behind barriers at the bottom of the mountain. But Moses went up the mountain. And there at the top of the mountain, God spoke. God spoke 10 great words. 10 great commandments. And then Moses carried those commandments down to the Israelites below. That's how God's law was given to the Israelites. But now, once again, you've got God's people who need to know God's will, to hear God's words. And again, they're going to hear God's words spoken on a mountain. But who are they going to see seated on the mountain? Whose voice is going to speak those words? Jesus. Jesus, the carpenter of Nazareth. He makes the mountain his throne. He speaks with absolute authority from that mountain. I say to you, he's not acting like Moses, who simply relayed the words of God, who carried them down. He's taking the place of God. He's speaking as God spoke on Mount Sinai. When Jesus took his seat there on the mountain, that's what he was proclaiming. By that very action, he was claiming to be God's equal. As he spoke, he was claiming to be the voice of God. That's why he could overrule the laws that Moses had given to Israel. Yes, those laws had come from God. But now the same God was speaking again and reshaping his laws for a new era. The kingdom of heaven had come down to earth in the person of Jesus himself. Jesus was claiming that he was entitled to speak and to legislate for God's kingdom. So who was he? Well, he answers that question very plainly in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7:21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Jesus does what no rabbi, no teacher, no expert had ever dared to do in Israel. He called God his Father. He declared that he was God's Son. And every person listening knew just what that meant. It didn't just mean that Jesus thought of himself as a very holy person. It meant that he shared God's nature. It meant that he was God's equal. You know, Jewish people had a very high view of the relationship between a father and a son. The way they looked at it was that when a man had a son, that son shared the father's nature. He was almost a part of his father. He was an extension of his father's being. Father and son had different roles, but they belonged together as one. The son would inherit everything that belonged to the father. A father would expect other people to treat his son as they would treat himself. It happened again and again in the history of Israel that the king, once his son had reached adulthood, would invite his son to share his throne. And they would reign side by side as equals. And Jesus was claiming all that for himself. He was saying, God is my Father, I am his son. He sent me down to earth as his representative, to reign on his behalf as his equal. He's in heaven, I'm on earth, but we are one. The carpenter from Nazareth was claiming that he was God's son, God's equal. People who heard Jesus call God his Father understood just what that meant. This is what we read in John's Gospel, chapter 5. This was why the Jews, the people of Jerusalem, were seeking all the more to kill Jesus. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Every time Jesus spoke of God as his Father, it must have sent a shockwave through his hearers. They must have been like that here. He's talking as if he's God's equal. No, he's saying he is God's equal. Every sentence of the Sermon on the Mount echoes that claim. Read through the Sermon on the Mount again and you'll see that all the way through he's speaking as if he's God. No, he's speaking as God. It's extraordinary. He not only calls God his Father, he claims the right to share that status, to pass it on to his disciples. You know, we've seen that in many places as we've gone through, haven't we? How often Jesus tells his disciples that from now on, they must think of God as their Father. Imagine in some far-off country, the king's son. He's a young lad away at boarding school. And there, away at boarding school, he makes a friend. And he invites his friend, a lad of his own age, to spend the holiday with him at the palace. And his friend is intimidated at the thought of staying for 6 weeks at the palace. He says, but what if I meet your father, the king? And the prince says, look, don't worry. While you're in the palace, as my friend, you must think of my father, the king, as dad. I'll be sitting next to him at the dinner table, and you can sit on the other side. And when I wake up in the morning, I often go into his bedroom and sit on the bed and talk to him, and you can come too. No one else could give that lad the right to do that. The Prime Minister couldn't give this lad from the school the right to treat the king as his dad. But if the prince says, my father is your father for the duration, then the lad can believe it. The young prince is determined to share his royal privileges with his friend. And that's what Jesus does. He, the one beloved eternal Son of God, he tells his disciples that from now on they speak to God and call him our Father. When Jesus taught his disciples that prayer, he was making a huge claim for himself. All the way through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven. He's saying that the kingdom of heaven has now come down to earth. But who does he assume reigns over the kingdom of heaven on earth? Who is its king? Who sets its laws? Who fixes its constitution? Jesus himself does. I say to you. Do you remember these words from chapter 5? Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. What's Jesus saying there? He's saying that the people who are going to own the kingdom are people who suffer on his account. People who suffer out of love for him, out of obedience to him, because of their relationship with him. What's Jesus saying? He's saying that whether a person is saved or not, whether they're accepted in the kingdom of heaven or not, hangs on their attitude to him and their relationship to him. What a thing for someone to say about himself. Your eternal destiny depends on how you relate to me. But that's what Jesus was saying. Long ago, I think they're probably the most quoted words he ever wrote. C.S. Lewis wrote this: a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. If you've understood the Sermon on the Mount, you'll understand just how true that is. Sane men, decent men, great religious teachers don't set themselves up as the last word, the final authority on everything. Great religious teachers don't talk as if they were God. They don't act in ways that make everyone think he's putting himself in the place of God. They don't claim that they're going to reign over God's kingdom forever. They don't claim that your eternal destiny, whether you go to heaven or hell, depends on your attitude to them. They don't finish their sermons by saying, there are only two sorts of people in the world. People who hear my words and put them into practice. People who don't. One group is safe forever. The other group is heading for disaster. But Jesus did all those things. And people were astonished. Not just because of the teaching he gave, but because of the authority with which he spoke. As he spoke, they knew that he was doing more than offering helpful teaching. He was demanding that they recognize him as God's son. He was insisting that they must give him total trust, total obedience, total submission, the worship that is due to God alone. And they were astonished. You know, there are plenty of famous people, world leaders, philosophers, social reformers, who have been very ready to praise the Sermon on the Mount and to recommend it to others. They talk about what a lovely guide it is for life. But they miss the most important thing about the Sermon on the Mount, the thing that the crowds were astonished by, the authority that Jesus claimed for himself. This is David Cameron. The Bible has helped give Britain a set of values and morals which make Britain what it is today. Values that speak to us all, to people of every faith and none. And then he goes on to mention in particular the Sermon on the Mount. He says, it's as relevant today as it was 2,000 years ago. And that's all he sees in the Sermon on the Mount. A set of values and morals that will always be relevant. You see, for Cameron, you can have those values without having Jesus himself. This is Kamala Harris. The Sermon on the Mount is filled with actions that help lead us into real faith. For example, if you want to be a more generous person, then go the extra mile. See, real faith, as far as she's concerned, means doing the right actions and becoming a nicer person. For example, a more generous person. And she says the Sermon on the Mount will help you do that. But no, real faith means looking at Jesus Christ, the man who claimed to be God's son, God's equal, the man who spoke as God and lived as God and was nailed to a cross for making those claims. It means looking at that man and believing in him, trusting him for everything, believing that he really was God living here among us, believing that when he died as the Creator, taking the punishment that his creatures have earned. It means believing that he rose again, and that he now shares the throne of heaven with his Father. Real faith means that you trust him to deal with the problem of your sin. Real faith means that you put yourself totally into his hands. Real faith means that you live your whole life under his protection, that you make him the whole purpose and the whole direction of your life. It's not what David Cameron wants it to be, that you follow the set of values and morals that Jesus spoke. And it's not what Kamala Harris wants it to be, becoming a more generous person. It's Jesus Christ himself, becoming your Lord, your King, your Saviour. It's knowing him personally. It's interacting with him daily, constantly, For me to live is Christ, said Paul. It was true. The crowds were astonished when they listened to Jesus. Have you ever been astonished by Jesus? Have you ever been left amazed, awed by him, himself? Have you been overwhelmed by his authority, his majesty, the claims he makes for himself? That's what a Christian is. Not just somebody who's bought into a new set of values and morals. A Christian is a person who's looked at Jesus and listened to Jesus and has been astonished. I said, I can't resist him. I can't stay away from him. I can't live without him. A Christian is somebody who has gone to Jesus and is clinging to Jesus, who is living by faith in him. If God wills, we're going to be pressing on into the Gospel of Matthew in the weeks and months ahead. Just looking at him. And on Sunday evenings, we're going to be looking at him again. We're going to be looking at his portrait from all four Gospels. And I trust that many of us will be astonished. That we'll be astonished as we look at Jesus. That we'll be like the crowds we read about here. People who have heard the voice of Jesus and know that henceforth he's going to be our all in all. May God speak to us in these days.